Good evening. There are many reasons why we come to practice. Everyone here has their own reason. But actually, it all comes down to one reason. We all share one particular reason for coming to practice, and that is we want to know ourselves spiritually. We want to know ourselves intimately, because we sense we do not really know ourselves, despite what we are known by during the day and with our family and friends. We know that's not really who we are, and we really want to know who am I in a large way. And so we come to the practice because we had a small glimpse of it, or some intuition that there is something to know. And we trust that it is real, this little glimpse that we had, this urge that says, I have to make an effort to know, I have to make an effort to know my real self. We trust that urge, even though it's ambiguous and mysterious at the start. But we do trust that it's real. And that trust is why we come to practice. Excuse me. So we start to practice, looking for our true self, but it eludes us when we first start. We can't see its shape or its color or its outline. And it eludes us, but we want to end the separation that we feel between our everyday self and our spiritual self. We want to make it here and not let it remain there. You know, we don't want our spiritual self to feel like it's outside of me. We want the me of the everyday world, myself, to come together with true self. And why we feel cut off from our spiritual self is, I think, has a great deal to do with having been raised in a very scientific and materialistic culture for the last 200 or 300 years. And that's the most significant characteristic of the modern world, this culture which has had a scientific direction rather than a spiritual direction for some centuries now. And this is quite understandable. We human beings have an inherent desire to create and to discover and make an effort to know the world we live in. We want to do that. So we push We push science as a way to discover the world we live in. But we know, we are now coming to know, the last 50 years, we are now coming to know in a subtle way that we are not just simply objects in a scientific and material world. But that's the way we have been raised, so it's hard to get a different viewpoint. We know we are more than a collection of desires, a collection of emotions, a collection of ambitions. We know that. But those are our habits. So it becomes a little difficult. We are becoming aware that we are alive not just to be successful or personally happy. There's more. And we are coming to understand that the materialistic approach is troublesome, can be troublesome. Because when we look around, when we look at our lives and the lives of others, we see we're not all that happy despite all the advances. Lots of material things, but we're not all that happy. What's wrong? The materialistic and the scientific direction that we humans have been moving in for the past few centuries has not ended wars. And it's probably helped create them. And it has resulted in pollution in the air and in the water where we live. So with all these advances in science, we're not happy, and we feel threatened even by what's going on. So we're saying there's another way. There has to be another way. And so we turn to spirituality to look for some answers. And when we first turn to spirituality, we expect that we will be able to set aside the troublesome world. And we feel that we will be able to live a more pure way of being. And then we discover that the old habits don't go away so easily. The old ways of thinking don't go away so easily. And we continue to think scientifically and materialistically. It doesn't go away. And we continue to think like consumers in a world of commodities. And it is starting to trouble us, all of us. It is starting to trouble us. Zen teacher who came from Japan came to California and to San Francisco in the 60s was Katagiri Roshi. Some of you may know the name. He was in San Francisco for a time, then became the teacher at Minnesota Zen Center. And he spoke one night and came up with a phrase that has stuck. People like to refer to it. He said, "You should settle yourself on yourself. Settle the self on the self." And people always quote that. What he really means is, you need to clear your mind. We need to clear our mind. Settle the self on the self. Settle down the small everyday mind on the big self. Clear the mind of delusions. Clear the mind of pretensions. Immerse ourselves in the reality of a present moment. I think the deeper meaning of that phrase, I think he meant we need to reflect on ourselves to determine if we are selfless. Look at yourself. Are you selfless or are you self-centered? Look at yourself. And on further reflection, it means if we don't know the answer to that question, or if we don't want to even look at it, we cannot really practice. Even though we may go through the motions, if we're not willing to look at that question, am I selfless or am I selfish? If we don't want to look at it, there's no practice there. I think this is what he meant by you should settle yourself on yourself. So our life these days, modern life, is very complicated, right? It's very distracting, especially Silicon Valley life. Lots of distractions, busy and fast. We have many conveniences and many comforts. And more and more, thanks to scientists, we continue to have a better understanding of the physical nature of the world. But do we understand ourselves? And scientists cannot help with that. Now we can practice alone, and we can practice independently. Put a cushion on the floor of a living room or bedroom and sit by ourselves. We can practice alone, or we can practice with the whole world. We can practice in this modern world that can be troublesome. But either way that we choose to practice, by ourself or with others, either way, the point is to come back to ourself, our true self. So we have to settle ourselves on ourself and continue to look at what is my attitude, how am I behaving? We want to know ourselves. We practice because we want to know ourselves, our fundamental self. We are not satisfied with knowing only the conditioned self of the material world. Like Suzuki Roshi said in a talk some time ago, we should know the fresh vitality within ourselves. The fresh vitality within ourselves. We should know it. We should make an effort to know it. Fresh vitality. So even though we practice in this modern world, we should not lose the fresh experience that exists in each moment of life, in each moment of awareness. We should not lose the fresh experience inherent in each new moment. So, our practice is when we are dedicated to, when we are dedicated to our practices, it gives us a life whose activity becomes the basis of our daily activity. Our practice becomes the basis of our daily activity. So it means we will base every daily activity on the foundation of our fundamental nature, who we are. So wherever we practice, alone or with others, or wherever we live our life, we need to remember, come back to the true foundation of our life. Life will always be difficult. It's rare to find a human life that doesn't have difficulties. And this is true today, but it was also true in the past, in ancient times. So we have natural disasters, we have sickness, we have cruelty, we have oppressive governments. All throughout history, these things have appeared. And so there's always suffering. And it can be easy to become discouraged by it all, or to become depressed by it. Yet, throughout history, and including today, we can always find people who are optimistic, even in the midst of all these difficulties. And this is not just religious people with expectations of some kind of future salvation. Some people are always optimistic, despite living in the midst of suffering. They reflect a universal optimism. And when we ask, what makes them that way? Do they have a single common quality or a single characteristic that makes them this way? And I think it is that they know themselves and they are content with who they are and with how they are. And they know that whatever they have in their life, it's enough. They're happy with it. They don't make themselves anxious by ideas of getting more. They know they have enough right now. And that's the key point of optimism, to know that we have enough. And that no matter where we go and no matter how our circumstances change, we will always have enough. When we know that and when we feel that, we can't help but be optimistic. So people who are optimistic are never concerned that they won't have enough. For them, pessimism is just not an option. When we meet somebody like that, we want to hang out. We want to be with that person. How do they do that? This optimism results in another quality, another personal quality, which is not being selfish, not being self-centered. People who are satisfied with their life just as it is, and who are optimistic in that way, are not self-centered. And they do care for, they do believe in a collective future, not just their own. They believe in it. They're optimistic about it. They don't care only for their personal future, because they understand that there's more than just this life. And no matter what their religious belief is or what their spiritual practice is, they know that the Dharma exists, even though they may never have heard of the word Dharma. They know the Dharma exists. They never heard of Dharma. Maybe they never heard of Buddha. And they may not be interested in philosophy. Yet that optimism is there. And they know. They know about the Dharma because they have dropped off self-centeredness. So this kind of optimism that some people have is not about achieving success in daily life, like winning a game or making a sale or signing a contract or solving some problem. Those things that mean success to us. The optimism that comes from making the sale or winning the game, solving the problem, that optimism is a temporary emotion. We get high for the moment, lasts for a day, and it can change if something else, something unexpected happens. So, I'm referring to an optimism that transcends all that. So this universal optimism is not disturbed, it's not shaken by setbacks. It's not upset by disappointments. It's the attitude in the story, the famous story, is that so? You know that story, is that so? Big disappointment. And the master says, is that so? And later, another disappointment, is that so? Is that so? The optimism, universal optimism, is not shaken by surprises and disappointments, setbacks. Is that so? So, for us to understand our true self, our spiritual self, we have to let go of being dependent on the changing nature of our daily life. Gee, I hope today turns out good. We're dependent, not to be dependent on successes that we hope for in our daily life. Our spiritual nature is always present. It's always available. It is not dependent on how the day goes. It's always here. So even if we have a setback during the day or disappointment or disagreement, we don't lose touch with our true nature. It's always here. So our practice is actually, I would say our practice is about uncovering our natural optimism. The universal optimism that all of us possess. when we feel that optimism, it is an expression of wisdom, of the intuitive sense of Dharma, and an intuitive sense of the truth of the nature of all things. This optimism will grow in us. It will appear and grow as we let go of our habitual tendencies, of our reactive tendencies. Our optimism, this optimism will be revealed. As we become more and more selfless. And as we stop seeing the world and we stop seeing our life as some kind of commodity. And stop seeing ourselves as a consumer. If we can get beyond that conditioning, we can really feel our optimism. And we become increasingly comfortable with ourselves and become convinced and confident that the Dharma is unfolding minute by minute. That is to say, the Dharma showing itself in kindness and generosity and selflessness. Even though we may be surrounded by people who don't display those tendencies, we know that in a very large way the Dharma is unfolding, and we want to be part of it. These qualities, kindness, generosity, unselfishness, these qualities are inherently present. They are always here. And this is the wisdom that reveals itself to us through our continuous practice. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please.
I might. I'm not sure about Zen, but what originally attracted me to Buddhism was the notion that it was neither optimistic nor pessimistic, but realistic. Like, if you take a test and you don't know how well you did, and you got an 87, you predict that you got an 87, not necessarily a 97 or a 77. You predict accurately. Like something that I was very, I hate to bring up a sort of subject, but something I was very optimistic recently was that Trump would lose the election. I was very sure of that. And then when the reality hit me, it hit me like a ton of bricks. So I was damaged by that. So my question is really how we update our optimism on reality so life doesn't hit us so hard. I mean, because the Buddha taught there's suffering in life. I mean, that's true. You know, so my question is really like, how do we avoid this sort of, you know, Pollyanna-ish optimism where we get taken advantage of, yet we maintain our optimistic attitude or, you know, our realistic and our optimism?
It's important to return to your vow. It's important to return to your practice. And to have an optimism that says, whatever happens, I'll take care of it. But if we say, I prefer this, and if that happens, oh my goodness. If that were to happen, I'm ready. I'm ready to respond. That's our practice. And with that kind of attitude, we avoid, what did you say, Pollyanna?
Yeah.
We can avoid Pollyanna if we have that attitude. Pollyanna attitude is, oh, isn't the world always lovely? We know it's not always lovely, but if we say, when it's unlovely, I'll stand up. It won't push me down. So we return to our practice. And that avoids the suffering from disappointment. Thank you. Hey, Dave.
So it strikes me less that this optimism that you're referring to isn't the sort of conventional understanding that we have of optimism, that we have a set of expectations about how we want things to come out. And our optimism is, in a sense, a form of denial that it can come out any other way than what we're expecting. I think the optimism that you're talking about really is, as you said, it's confidence in the unfolding of the Dharma. It's perhaps closer to what we talk about as composure, facing our life with composure. I remember one of my very earliest childhood experiences, I must have been about 3, was I was alone in the car with my father. And my father, I always referred to as being sort of a goofy optimist, in the not the sense of optimism that you mean, but rather the sort of Pollyanna denial that anything could go wrong. And this is a very heavily emotionally loaded memory for me, because I was terrified that something was wrong. I think probably what was happening was that my mother was in the hospital and my younger brother was being born, but I didn't understand what was going on. And I was trying to convey to my father this terrible, terrible fear that I had, and he wasn't listening. Because his optimism at that point was not confidence, it was denial. And I felt all alone. I think that's the really important lesson for me, at least, in what you said, is that the word optimism here doesn't really mean this focus on our self-centered expectations of how we want things to be and denial that they can be otherwise. It's confidence that in the unfolding of the Dharma we'll be able to face our life with composure. At least that's what it means to me.
Yes. Yes. So what is the lesson in that memory that you recall?
The lesson for me is that this shallow kind of optimism is a way of not only isolating yourself from your fears, but isolating yourself from other people. And that was why I felt so alone.
Good lesson. Thank you. Oh, Lee, yes.
I just want to say thank you so much for this lecture, which so all of us really, I think, are in one way or another kind of suffering because of the outcome that none of us really expected. And maybe we feared but we didn't really believe could become a reality. And so it's a really important, it's very important strength and support that you give us in this concept of dealing with something, not, you know, as we were saying, not a, you know, a foolish way of optimism, but of saying we're going to be strong and, you know, we will handle things as they come. We will take care of it. And it's kind of, as we were joking the other day, we were talking about the privet tree that always keeps coming back from a little piece of root. And we were joking and saying, we need privet spirit.
Yeah, very stubborn.
that stubbornness to say, okay, I'm down now, but I'm coming back. You know. So thank you very much.
The people who are disappointed in the election, it would, it's a mistake to get sarcastic and say, and start saying nasty things, or I'll get you, or something like that. That better is to say, okay, how can I be creative in this situation? How do I respond to this in some creative way? I think we're all trying to figure that out now. And I think they will. The people who are disappointed will figure out a way to be creative. And I'm optimistic about that. Thank you. Oh, Anna.
I think it was you that taught me that to be truly spontaneous, you had to be present and mindful to solve problems and be creatively spontaneous. And I was wondering if you thought optimism played into that too, to solve problems right now.
Yes, I think when a problem comes up, I think we have to start with the attitude that says, I can do this, and then work on it. And we make it to the point of saying, no, I really can't. It's too much. But we have to start with at least that attitude and make an effort. And just that trying increases the optimism. Thank you. Yes, we are.
So, there was this movie that came out like 10 years ago or 12 years ago called Wag the Dog.
Wag the Dog?
Yeah. So, Dustin Hoffman's character is his producer, and Robert De Niro comes up to him and says, this, you know, how can this happen? How can the president have an affair? He said, don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. I made a movie called The Four Men of the Apocalypse, and three men of the apocalypse were dead. We had to go with one, so this is nothing. That's kind of the spirit that, you know, things keep coming at you, and you just have to keep going. So, it just came to me as this amusing thing that came to my head. So what happens to people is like sometimes problems arise and we take care of things.
Thank you.